Thank you so much. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me to be part of this incredible forum and this incredible weekend. To say that I'm proud of the campaign is an understatement. It is my source of inspiration on a daily basis in my teaching, in my academic work, in my advocacy, and my activism. And I've learned so much from those who are being honored, and as a way of not only learning about the sort of spirit of survival and revolution in the face of such brutal inhumanity, but also I get inspiration from all of you for just how to live my life. So I congratulate you, and I thank you for doing that for me every day. Thank you. So coming in as the last speaker has its benefits, which is that a lot of what I was worried that I had to cover in a short amount of time, although it feels like a long time, it's hard to describe a system affecting 167 million people that's over 3,000 years old in a matter of 30 minutes or so. But the benefit of coming at the end is that I can now refer to the incredible presentations that have already been made and from which I have learned a lot myself. I also wanted to foreground what I'm going to talk about and relate what others have already talked about with a little bit of perspective on what does this actually look like on a day-to-day basis, not in terms of the violence and brutality that we've heard about, but just daily living and conversation in India. And I'm very thankful that I have a film with me that does some of that. I'm only going to show 10 minutes of it, and perhaps the organizers can arrange for a separate full screening. The film was made by a very talented and incredible activist and filmmaker named Stalin Kay, who worked with many members of the campaign, NGO members throughout the country, to really document the extent of untouchability as it's practiced across all faiths in India and across the rural and urban so-called divide in India. So many people think about this as a rural phenomenon. So before getting into sort of the meat of my talk, I thought I would just play 10 minutes of that film to bring us onto the same page in terms of what's happening.
And the meal?
No.
I saw her again, Baru, and they're going to
help. But I, yeah, no.
The mother came with you. A girl comes. A machine numbs you. Machine numbs you.
Hillen.
Die on the hello. अंदर नहीं आओ
ना
कैम
अबड़े एट ले तो मैं तन्नो अबड़े
तुम्हें कौन दिया अबड़ा
हली
या से बड़ा लोग इंडियन घरे अबड़ा अब इसे एक मटार दियो बदाई ना क्या रहे ना काम करना है
ना माथे हाथ फिरो तो सूट है तू ये
अब डाम में भाई ये ना क्या रहे ना काम करना है काट दिया जाम
रमेश तू क्या कोड़ी जो रमेश
भरवाड़
बद्दा भरवाड़ जो
हरी
जी हाँ
पंजी
पंजी मेरी जी
कौन तुम्हारे घरे आ गया लोगों कैम
आवे खराब पन अंदर घरमाने बाल
तो ने कौन की दो ये वो के तुम्हें अभड़े जावे
कोई नहीं खबर पड़ेगी ना
तुम तुम्हारे इतना खबर ऊपर हाथ मुकुल उबारो आलोकन साथे
ना ना
कैम
अबड़ाई ला अबड़ शर्ट से ईद मन नहीं कर रहा अबड़ शर्ट इतना हूँ
तो पहली बात हम अपना परिचय दे दें आपको। मेरा नाम बटुक प्रसाद शर्मा शास्त्री है, मैं स्वामी करपात्री जी महाराज का शिष्य हूँ और ये जो तुलसी मानस मंदिर है इसका मैं अधीक्षक हूँ और काशी के जो विद्वानों की मंडली है श्री काशी विद्वत परिषद का मैं महामंत्री हूँ। उसके बाद शास्त्र को आधार मानने वाला होने के नाते मैं कट्टर हिंदू ब्राह्मण हूं, छुआछूत जात पात मानता हूं। देखो वो जो दिव्य पुरुष है, वेद विराट पुरुष है, उसके ब्राह्मणोस्य मुखम आशीत, उसके मुख से ब्राह्मण पैदा हुआ, ठीक है। बाहु राजन्याः, बाहु से क्षत्रिय, ऊरु तदस्य जनवैश्याः, पेट से, यहाँ ये जो स्थान है ना, यहाँ से वैश्य पैदा हुआ। पदभ्याम शूद्रो अजायत, पैरों से शूद्र अजायत बने पैदा हुआ, ठीक है, वेद कह रहे हैं, ये वेद की वाणी, जो हमारी वेद माता है वही सृष्टि का विधान वही बताती है, ठीक है। तो शास्त्र जो शास्त्र की दृष्टि से जो देखा जाएगा वही ठीक होगा और कोई ठीक नहीं होगा।
ஊருக்குள்ளே போகும்போது கொஞ்சம் ஒரு மரியாதை போகணும்ப்பா, பாரம்பரியமாக முன்னால் முதியோர்கள், அதாவது நம்ம எங்களுக்கு முன்னால் இருந்தவங்க வந்து இதில் யாருமே செருப்பு போட்டு போக மாட்டாங்க,
அப்படி போட்டு போனால் என்ன
ஆகும், போட்டு போகக்கூடாது, அங்கிட்டலாம் போடலாம், அவங்க பிடிச்ச போடலாம், நான் அங்கன்னு போடக்கூடாது, ஊருக்குள்ள அவங்க இருந்தாலும் ஒரு சாரிக்கு ஒரு சாரி கேட்டாப்பா,
இருக்குதுல்ல
બધા છકડા મળ્યા ગામમાં, બધા છકડા
બધા
બોલવા બોલવાનું રાખો છો તો કાંઈક થોડુંક ભાષણ દે ને. અમારા ગામમાં બધા બહુ
જેઠ ભંજ્યા ન બેહાડે, બાકી બધાને બેહાડે. જેઠ ભંજ્યા છે આ લોકો બળાય છે. જેમ પહેલા પાછા એવા રજૂઆત કરતા કે અમારે હીરાવાળા ઉતરી જાય તેમ બેહો એટલે કંઈ અંદર એ લોકો ટિફિન હોય ને તો ટિફિન ના ભરાઈ જાય.
செருப்பு சட்டப்படி எங்களை ஊருக்குள்ளே போட்டு வரக்கூடாது. கடைக்கு போகும்போது அந்த தூண்கள் இருந்துச்சுல, அது பக்கத்தில் நான் அவுத்து வச்சுருக்கேன். நான் வந்து அதை அவுத்து வைக்காமல் வந்திருந்தேனாக்கா எனக்கு அடி தான்.
मैं मिस्त्री का काम करता हूँ, अभी गांव में एग्रीकल्चर व्यवसाय.
ओसी है, बीसी है?
हाँ.
उनके घर में भी आप काम करते हैं कि वो बुलाते नहीं?
जब भी नया घर बनाता है उस टाइम में अंदर भी सब हम लोग ही बनाता है. घर पूरा होने के बाद कलर वलर सब मारने के बाद अंदर नहीं आने देता.
क्यों नहीं आने देता?
उन दलितों लोग ऐसे नहीं आने देता.
दाई है इस गांव में?
हाँ,
हाँ माँ. क्या क्या करते हैं?
अब ये लड़का बच्चा होता है तो उसको ला रखा है, पूरन करता है, रहता है, बीता करता है, पानी पड़ता साफ फेंकता उगता है, कपड़ा लता उसके साथ. बच्चा जो होता है उसको नहाना धोना और 5-6 बजे उसको सेंक भी देता है, तेल लगाता है.
कितना मजदूरी?
100.
उनके यहाँ पे काम करने जाते हैं तो वहाँ पे पानी मिलता है आपको?
खाना
मिलता है?
पानी मिलता है.
उनके साथ बैठ के खाते हैं?
नहीं, बैठ के कैसे खेले? भनसाव खाएगा, हम बाहर में खाएगा.
अंदर नहीं जाने देता. शादी ब्याह पे बुलाते हैं?
शादी ब्याह क्या बोले तो
खाली
कमाए घर. शादी ब्याह तरह क्या बोले तो कमा भेज लो तो अपन घर जा. शादी ब्याह क्या बोले तो शादी ब्याह. शादी ब्याह नहीं
क्यों
तो मुसरनी है ये है. मैं चाहे जितना हम राजपूतनी है कि हम बामिनी है कि
क्या बात है आज आप हमारी मूवी बना रहे
हैं? कॉर्पोरेशन का काम करती है?
हाँ जी.
आप लोग किस बिरादरी के?
वाल्मीकि हैं हम तो.
अच्छा, आप किसी को भी जानते हैं कॉर्पोरेशन में जो इस बिरादरी का नहीं है और ये काम करता है?
हमारी कॉर्पोरेशन में तो कोई ऐसा है नहीं.
बिरादरी के हैं आप लोग? क्या काम करते हैं आप लोग?
जितना रेल में डेड बॉडी होता है सब हम लोग फेंकते हैं.
ट्रेन तो चलती है बहुत स्पीड में, झटका लगता है उसको, उस झटका के कारण से पीस पीस हो जाता है इंसान. और वो पीस को उठा उठा के एक जगह उसको यहाँ है वहाँ है इस तरह से लाते हैं चुनकर एक जगह उसको सेट करके उसको फोटो होता है और उसके बाद हम लोग के यहाँ पोस्टमार्टम करने के लिए भेज देता है. जब
सड़ सड़ जाता सर उसको हम लोग उठा उठा के दम कन्हा पर उठा के ले जाते हैं. हम लोग को बदबू करता है, 10 दिन तक बदबू करता है सर, लाहत उठा देता है.
तो मतलब आपकी नौकरी नहीं है रेलवे में?
नहीं सर.
गाय देखिए मरता हम उठाते हैं, कुत्ता मरता हम उठाते हैं, बिल्ली मरता हम फेंकते हैं, जितना गंदगी काम आपको जो पैखाना जो करते हैं उसको गंदगी काम हम फेंकते हैं, कोई बड़का जात तो नहीं फेंकने आता। और हरिजने पर इतना कष्ट दिया जा रहा है जब न जब
தோட்டி போட்ட எங்களுக்கு மழை சாக்கடையில் நீ இறங்குவோம் சாரி என்ன சொல் எனக்கு இட்டுப்பட்டு செத்தோ மடா மேல வளவுல வெந்தே மடிஞ்சோ மடா வெண்மணியில இட்டுப்பட்டு செத்தோ மடா மேல வளவுல
सनातन धर्म की या हिंदू धर्म जिसे आप लोग कहते हैं उसकी रीढ़ की हड्डी बड़ा व्यवस्था।
So think of that as an enticing trailer that and that you should see the rest of the film. The problem, of course, with showing a film that is so well made is that in comparison, listening to me is not going to be very exciting. But still, I've been asked to sort of put this into a little bit of context. There are other parts of the film that also show and speak to Dalit students and show the ways in which they are made uniformly to sit in the back of classrooms, how they are denied access to midday meals and discriminated against in all aspects of their education by the teacher. And also takes us to urban areas and shows the ways in which this is not just a rural phenomenon, but how those conversations get played out in anti-reservation protests that a number of students in institutions of higher education in the country are now carrying forward using the banner of meritocracy, of equality. The Youth for Equality group is one made up of doctors and others who are carrying out anti-reservation protests in the name of protesting the suggested expansion of reservations to include the other backward castes. They have been known to be wearing their white coats and coming out in the streets in Delhi and sweeping and saying the reservations are turning us into sweepers. At the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, where I was born, so I'm very angry that they're doing this. There have been sharp protests and harassment and abuse of Dalit students that is not an anomaly, but indicative of the treatment of Dalit students across the country, including burning the very texts of Dr. Ambedkar, Dalit leader and father of the Indian Constitution, without whose innovative work and championing of Dalit rights, we wouldn't even be here today to have this conversation. So I wanted to put that in the context of the conversations about affirmative action, about violence, and everything, because it says something when those who are now trying to defeat affirmative action in the country are allowed to co-opt the language of equality so easily without recognizing the irony of saying that we are youth for equality, but we are going to demean Dalits by pretending that we're sweepers and essentially saying you have no place in this institution. The debate is against the other backward caste category, but the backlash is always felt by Dalits, including violent backlash whenever there's been an expansion of reservations proposed. Also, I wanted to show a little bit of the film because it tells you a little bit about the daily life across the country. The number of states that are covered in the film are exactly to make that point, that this is not happening in a particular pocket in the country. It talks also about and shows how it's practiced across faiths. This is not just about Hindus practicing this. And it shows what happens in cities and in rural life. All of that gives lie to a lot of the counter narratives that are proposed to indicate that this is a quaint problem. It has been dealt with the law. It is a small issue that is going away. Economic growth is solving the problem. Ashwini talked about very much how showed empirical data showing that was not the case. And finally, that we have a wonderful constitution and all the laws on the books and all of them, putting them in place is sort of the sine qua non to real equality. And we've done our job by abolishing de jure discrimination. But what has survived in its place is certainly is a form of kind of de facto inequality, violence, and exploitation that now just gets hidden under the veneer of the law. So what I wanted to add to all the presentations today was a few things. First is I wanted to situate this in a global context to describe how this is not an India-specific phenomenon and to also show the relationship that it shares with struggles for racial justice and caste-based justice across the world. I then wanted to explain what I see as the real challenge that the caste system poses to human rights. This is, after all, a human rights symposium, a human rights in honor of a human rights award, awarding the National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights. What is the National Campaign taking on when it starts to talk about Dalit human rights? I wanted to present the challenge that the caste system faces, and also wanted to say a little bit about the challenge that the free market poses to human rights itself. As individuals in the room who are either students of human rights or aspiring advocates, academics of human rights, I think it's important to sort of put human rights in its place and understand its constraints in order to most effectively use it. So what do I mean by human rights? I mean not only the constitutional vision, but also all the Bill of Rights that come in through the international human rights framework seen through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and the Children's Rights Convention, and so many more that India is a state party to. It means that it has signed on to or ratified all of these treaties. It has binding obligations under international human rights law. It is a member of the UN Human Rights Council, yet it can sign these treaties, it can make its presentations to various treaty bodies, and it can still allow this to take place. So where does human rights enter into this conversation, and does it actually have any traction? To begin with, to situate this in global context, 167 million people in India, a population greater than half the size of the United States, is subject to routine and daily humiliation, segregation, harassment, and exploitation and violence in the country today. When you add to that the numbers of individuals, as Andrew has said, who are not considered scheduled caste, but who converted to either Islam or Christianity. Buddhism falls into the SC category, but the number begins to look much bigger, and the estimates aren't very clear, but I would add maybe another 40 million or so to that. So you're already looking at a population in the country, you know, teetering over the edge of 200 million people. Add to that the situation of Dalits in Pakistan, in Sri Lanka, in Nepal, in Bangladesh, and you end up realizing that this is a subcontinental kind of epidemic or a disease. In Nepal, much of the reason for the justification of the Maoist insurgency has actually been justified on the basis of social exclusion, on the basis of caste. That's a complicated story. I won't get into it. I can point you to other resources. In Sri Lanka, the kind of the Tamil fight or the Tamil plantation workers also come from Dalit communities and who are denied statehood and citizenship all the time in the country. Bonded laborers and the phenomenon of bonded laborers in Pakistan, looking a little bit more closely and removing the veneer of the symptoms, you get down to the disease and realize that a majority of the bonded laborers in Pakistan come from Dalit communities. And in Bangladesh, the sanitation workers, generally speaking, anybody relegated to perform some kind of a polluting occupation, also share this membership in this outcast community. In Japan, the Baraku community that many might be familiar with also suffer from caste or caste-like forms of discrimination. And in Africa, in Senegal, Yemen, Somalia, Nigeria, and many other countries, caste-based systems are the sort of the social entity around which exclusion is organized and privilege is constructed for those who are included. I want to bring this all into the conversation because suddenly the numbers start looking a lot higher, maybe 250 million, maybe 260, maybe 300 million. The fact that the numbers are so high is one reason for us to be alarmed. The fact that it exists at all, even if it were affecting 100 people, 10 people, one person in this room, should give us pause that what have we brought to this conversation as human rights advocates and activists. Many of these systems I've described share a lot of basic features in common. I won't go into detail, but just to point out that a lot of what was described earlier in the presentations, that it's a very strict endogamous system, which means that you marry within your caste, your subcaste even, that strict endogamy function is how caste is perpetuated. What would start happening if all the castes began intermarrying, if this was a descent-based status? Caste would slowly disappear, and so the violence that's meted out when Dalits, marry non-Dalits, is you can start seeing in light of the kind of function that endogamy performs. The purity and pollution line, also very clear in all the countries that I've mentioned. Labor and the extent to which particular Dalits have 100% reservation in manual scavenging or other particular labor categories that Vincent talked about as well is also common to each. And the systematic denial of access to resources, to the share of economic growth, and also, as Ambedkar has poignantly said, the denial of very human personality is also common to a lot of the countries. Another commonality that I see in all of them is that they fundamentally exist in what I would call, and others have kind of talked about in the non-caste context, in a state of exception. But the state of exception is not exception or exceptional, it's a state at which kind of swallows the norm. In this case, the state of exception being that they are relegated to a space in the country, in the national consciousness, in which the rule of law does not apply. If the rule of law doesn't apply, then what rules are perpetuating the system? And through the film, you got a very small glimpse into the rules of the caste system. And that is what is followed, and that's what trumps a lot of the considerations over the rule of law. You can also go beyond the caste system and start to put this in conversation with struggles for racial justice. The Indian Prime Minister, the current sitting Prime Minister, Dr. Manmohan Singh, did just that on December 27th of last year when he became the first sitting Prime Minister of India to openly draw a parallel between untouchability and apartheid in South Africa. In so doing, he essentially created the first official opening to bring the Dalit plight into conversation with the Black South African or even the African American struggles. But unofficially, those conversations and the cross-fertilization between those movements has been going on for decades before that. So the analogy between apartheid and untouchability is a very appropriate one and makes people very uncomfortable on other levels, right? So immediately people will jump to say, well, apartheid was about legal discrimination. There's nothing legal about this. Or apartheid is a race issue. It's a black and white issue. Caste is not race. Or apartheid is something that in South Africa itself has been defeated. You can deny that. On those are the counter-narratives that are offered. And one of the reasons why the system has been given the name of hidden apartheid is precisely because the way that the law functions and the human rights veneer functions is really to hide the daily practice that is shown in the film and that others have already talked about. The way that it's denied is also makes the system as obvious and hidden in plain sight as it is, it renders a lot of these issues invisible. And I think that the empirical research that Ashwini was talking about and that along with S.K. Thorat and others are engaging in is really groundbreaking in making visible something that is made even more invisible by the victory of the Constitution or by the Indian government claiming that it is supporting human rights. Apartheid also has to be understood, I think, in two ways. The first, it has to be understood in terms of an actual legal framework or system of laws that institutionalizes discrimination and gives legal or state sanction to a system, which, as you've seen from the Constitution, India does not do. But apartheid also can be seen, I think, as describing a particular racist or casteist mindset that creates barriers between individuals and keeps from social interaction from happening, and that's inculcated in individuals from an extremely young age. The opening of that film with children, I think, brings some of these conversations about merit and how easy it is just to have a law and then have the law be the final arbiter of rights, it brings those into sharp relief, because if you're told from a very young age that you are superior or have privilege because you come from X caste or that you have no business being in school, pushing Dalit students to the back of the classroom, they get pushed and pushed and pushed and they fall out of the educational system altogether. So conversations about merit in India and also in the United States, where a lot of the issues are very similar in terms of the conversations, have to be understood not as a disturbance to meritocracy, right? But really as creating the possibility of meritocracy, because the caste system itself is so antithetical to merit. The idea that you are born into your occupation, especially on the the extreme spectrums of it, you know, there aren't non-Brahmin priests for the most parts, and there are not non-Dalit scavengers for the most part. If you are born into something and it's your birth that determines your aptitude to be a scholar, a priest, a teacher, or a scavenger, then where is the level playing field that reservations are supposedly disturbing right now? And I think that those are the kinds of counter conversations that are happening in many countries around the world, as there is a almost organized, I would say, a common backlash to the notion of affirmative action, whether it's in the United States or in France or Brazil, India, even South Africa, where the newness of the claiming of political majority and democracy, you would think, would insulate the country from these arguments, yet they're already starting to creep up in the courts. I do want to now turn to kind of what I see as what's happening in terms of the Constitution and human rights and the challenge that it poses. So the challenge that the system poses, I think, is one that Ambedkar himself foresaw when he was giving a speech to the Constituent Assembly trying to explain the real space of the Constitution in the country. And the Constitution was drafted along the same time and over the same few years as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What Ambedkar said was that on the 26th of January 1950, we are going to enter into a life of contradictions. In politics, we will have equality, and in social and economic life, we will have inequality. In politics, we'll be recognizing the principle of one man, one vote, and one vote, one value. In our social and economic life, we shall, by reason of our social and economic structure, continue to deny the principle, one man, one value, to which I would just amend, one human, one value. The idea that you can have this on paper, but in daily reality, you don't even give full human status or personality to an individual, is the reason why constitutional intentions and visions have been frustrated on a daily basis in India and in many of the other countries that I've described. In that sense, in the world's largest democracy, an enormous proportion of that, of those individuals, are actually rendered to be stateless citizens. They might be citizens on paper, but if you understand citizenship to include a bundle of rights that includes the right to free association, the right to vote, the right to political participation, then those rights are really only given in a very superficial and perfunctory way to Dalits in the country. And the reality that they exhibit is really one of occupying the two ends of the spectrum of brutality and neglect, which I would also call kind of the over-enforcement, under-enforcement phenomenon. So under-enforcement, as a strategy itself, or just looking at the issue of under-enforcement, you start to realize why all the laws that have been talked about become just paper tigers without little effect. I'll say a few words about over-enforcement first, because they haven't really captured our conversation today, but over-enforcement also comes in when particular laws that are themselves extremely draconian laws, and among them I would include sort of unconstitutional provisions of the Indian Penal Code that have been kind of inherited from colonial culture, or anti-terrorism laws or national security laws, are routinely over-enforced against Dalit communities, which goes back to the earlier question of sort of human rights terrorists, right? So anytime there's an assertion that comes out for the demand for rights, it's a threat to national security. Under-enforcement comes in not just in the Prevention of Atrocities Act or the Protection of Civil Rights Act or the Constitution, the provisions of which Vincent laid out earlier today, but also in a plethora of other social welfare legislation and economic development measures. And here I would actually argue that affirmative action, if it's seen as any caste-conscious measure designed to correct inequality or remedy historic and contemporary manifestations of abuse, then all of those fall under the affirmative action package that India has to offer, reservations of which are one piece, and the piece in which all of the conversation sort of gets debated and defeated without realizing, as Ashwini has said, that it affects a minute percentage of the population. Even there, caste-based discrimination is practiced in the implementation of reservation, and the whole liberalization package is making the public sector so small now that its even limited reach is shrinking. So when you go, you know, kind of remove the lens and widen it to the rest of the 99% of the population, there are other laws that exist. There's the prohibition of employment of manual scavengers. There's the prohibition or eradication of the Devdasi system, which is a forced prostitution system affecting Dalit women and girls in particular. particular states. There's the Bonded Labor Prohibition Act. There's the Child Labor and Other Hazardous Forms of Labor Act. And the list goes on and on and on. There may, in fact, be more laws than there are people in the country. And also what's true is that those laws are actively undermined and sabotaged every single day, including the extremely powerful, if implemented, Prevention of Atrocities Act. Why is it that the laws fail? I think that for me, I would situate that answer into three areas. The first is corruption. But here, I want you to understand casteism as a form of corruption, and not just the corruption that says you pay a petty bribe and you won't get charged, but when the entire law enforcement machinery, from the judiciary to the police to those registering the cases to the district collector to the prosecutors, is dominated by a caste system that they have inherited from school on up and that they enforce, then what is enforced is not the rule of the law, but the rule of the caste system. And you see that in the extremely high acquittal rates, even for the most egregious crimes. So there I would just add that corruption should not just be seen as bribes, which Dalits can ill afford to pay anyway, but also as a form in which the natural state of the rule of law, whatever that might be, is undermined by allegiance to something else. That's how corruption is defined. And here that allegiance is to one's caste or a common commitment in the practice of untouchability. Violence as the second reason. The violence against Dalits in the country, I think, has reached sort of epidemic proportions today. And to the tune of 13 Dalits being murdered every week, 5 Dalit homes being set on fire, 6 Dalits kidnapped or abducted every week, and every day, 3 Dalit women raped, 11 assaulted, and a crime committed against a Dalit every 18 minutes. These are from official statistics, but official statistics, as you can imagine, represent probably the tip of the iceberg of what's going on, because most Dalits, for fear of the retaliation, basically self-select themselves out of the process of even going to the police. A recent survey that was published by ActionAid and that was carried out last year surveyed the practice of untouchability in 565 villages and found that in over a quarter of the villages, Dalits were not even allowed to enter the police station. So when we talk about the laws and the rule of law, you have to, what purpose does it hold if Dalits cannot even enter the station and are highly likely to be raped or tortured by the police themselves if they actually do try to engage with justice mechanisms? That has to be brought to bear. What role is violence playing then? Violence is playing the role of caste entrenchment in this case, because the violence is very much a response to, and this I think has to be highlighted, the violence is a response to a rise or a movement for assertion. And so when you look at violence, I would just implore you not to look at the violence as a symptom of Dalit victimization. Certainly it represents that, but also as showing the resilience and the revolution that's actually happening, that there actually is that much assertion actually is what triggers the need for that violence and the need to entrench the economic, political, and social power that kind of assertion disturbs, whether it's simply drawing water from a public well or demanding land rights, as happened by the tune of over 25,000 people in Delhi just this past week, or the simple act of just choosing the person that you're going to marry and not caste. Those are acts of revolution, and the violence is meant as a counter-revolutionary strategy. The third area I would highlight is the notion of invisibility. Caste is like, I use the analogy that it's like oxygen in India. It is invisible yet indispensable to the functioning of the country. It's invisible because even with all the media stories that I can point you to, I did a study of just 1 week of looking at the number of cases that were highlighted in the media the week of September 20th that were delivered to me, thankfully, by the National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights, which has a fantastic listserv, which I implore you all to join, that showed within the space of 1 week the nature and kinds of atrocities that were reported across the country. Even one of those, one would hope, would bring a country like Norway or anywhere else grinding to a halt, demanding justice. These were happening on a daily basis. That very same week, you also saw stories of marches, protests, the setting up of commissions, the setting up of cells, taking public interest litigation cases to the courts. So the twin story of violence also has to be shown matched with the story of resilience and strategies that are being used. in comes human rights into this conversation, which is how I want to spend sort of the remaining minutes that I have. Within this, you have a real challenge, as I said, that this system obviously poses to human rights at a very fundamental level. Human rights, and especially the foundational document of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, basically tells us that all human beings are born inherently equal and you know, given a set of kind of inalienable rights. The caste system tells us the exact opposite. It says that individuals are born inherently unequal, and not just unequal, but into a system of graded inequality. Equality in which everybody is given a particular place in the pecking order. What does that system do? Well, number one, it refutes the very foundation of human rights, but also by giving everybody a space just above someone else, it invites people to enjoy the spoils of iniquity while themselves being victimized by it. And it's one of the reasons, as has already been pointed out this morning, that it becomes so difficult to fight the system. It's the internalization of that inequality. Another thing that human rights does, much in the same way, and by this I mean sort of the mechanism that traditional human rights, and there's a lot of examples of non-traditional behavior in this room that I'm a part of and very proud of, the traditional mechanism has been to ask the states to, well, here's a set of laws, implement them, or make them come into line with your international human rights obligations or your constitution. Or it says, this is happening, dear Prime Minister, can you please make sure that this doesn't happen and correct this? So what we talked about earlier, Ashwini was pointing to kind of the trickle-down theory of economic growth, which doesn't work. There's this trickle-down theory of human rights as well, that if I direct my admonitions to the higher echelons of government, or I put the laws in place on paper, then it's going to trickle down and it's going to change this apartheid mindset that I spoke of earlier. And not enough work is actually happening to unroot the system from the bottom up. It's also not happening in the law books. Vincent pointed out earlier that there is actually no abolishment of the caste system. It abolishes untouchability. So how can you actually abolish untouchability if the Brahmin will always be a Brahmin? You know, you hear a lot about the former untouchables in India. Nobody steps up and says, I'm a former Brahmin, I'm a former Vaishya, I'm a former Kshatriya, because that identity is left unquestioned. And if you leave the identity of caste supremacy unquestioned, then how are you going to resolve and create inequality, whether it's through a system of laws or any rhetoric? I'll end by also just in the last few minutes saying a little bit about the role of the state and what the free market does. Here as well, international human rights proponents have really clinged to the state as the agent of social transformation. I think what becomes extremely clear in the Indian context, which provides a mirror for how a lot of inequality and oppression works around the world, is that you cannot assume that the state is a neutral actor. The state is made up of the same kinds of hierarchies that allow the system to flourish to begin with. And also, the state on its own, you know, who is it actually targeting? The other problem with the trickle-down theory, I think, is that all the strategies are trickling down to sort of rescue the personality of the untouchable victim. And where are those strategies that are looking at the casteist mindset that, Paul, I think you called, you know, that should be institutionalized and should be in mental institutions, people who are urinating into people's mouths, who are forcing them to eat human waste, who are perpetuating this violence at night and going to be bankers and teachers in the day, where are the affirmative action programs that says to them, you are, this is, your personality is what needs to be reclaimed? And I think shifting the focus away from the Dalits as victims towards the perpetrators and untackling that is a project that I think is still, that's been left undone, at least by the international community. The free market is the other place I said I would come to. And here, too, by the free market, I mean basically the dismantling of the state. So the state is not only not neutral, but the state is not what it used to be. Because the notion and ethos of liberalization has led to a dismantling of state structures and controls, not just in India, but across the world. And with that, all the obligations that attach to the state as the holder of those obligations and duties have actually, their functions have been outsourced, but the obligations are not getting outsourced with them. So another challenge that I think is posed here, and where the International Dalit Solidarity Network is playing a huge role, is to also now turn its attention to the private sector. Not just the private sector, but also aid agencies, development agencies, the World Bank, you know, multilateral institutions. During the tsunami, in the follow-up to the devastation caused by the tsunami, it was the campaign and IDSN and a very valuable report that came out in addition from the, well, Gerard Unk, who's sitting here, called Making Things Worse, and the Netherlands Network, that looked at the ways in which discrimination maps on to and clings even in times of natural disaster. The campaign affirmed that with its recent trips to Bihar, where flooding was so severe and bad that but Dalits were once again kept out of the relief or rehabilitation package, with the reasoning, as Paul said in a media interview, that, well, this is, they're used to surviving on very little, so we don't actually have to help them, and they can wait in turn until everybody else has been given their fair share. The role of the state, therefore, has to be obviously kept in the forefront, but also, have we left society, have we left the private sector, have we left all the pieces of international institutions that play a huge role in the daily economic and social lives of Indian citizens out of the focus of human rights? And I think that's another major challenge. I'll wrap up now, but I want to wrap up with actually a bit of a call to action and to tell you where you can go for more resources, because a lot of information has been kind of presented to you today. Many of you have extreme familiarity with it already, which is obvious from the I think very probing questions that have been asked. For those of you who don't, there's a number of resources. There's some in the back of the room that are from a number of us. There are others that I can point you to that are on our website and on other websites. And there's also the film, which I hope will be shown. But I do want to end by sort of capturing why it is we're here today. And with that, also, once again, turning to Ambedkar, who has claimed, and who we all include as a catch line at the end of our emails, that this is not a battle for wealth or for power. It is a battle for freedom. It is a battle for the reclamation of human personality. I would want to end by inviting you to be kind of part of that battle and part of that struggle. I think it was mentioned earlier that the International Dalit Solidarity Network has a number of European-based support networks. We are hoping to create one in Norway. You can all be part of that exciting movement. And what liberalization has done, we've talked about, but it also comes along with globalization. And what globalization has done is that it has helped put Dalit activists into conversation with a number of other activists who are themselves facing similar struggles. That was most obvious at the World Conference Against Racism, I think, and those conversations continue. And it also puts activism in touch with those who are sitting here and in other places of the world who I'm sure are sort of ripping their hair out thinking, how can this possibly exist? And then also asking you now that you can be a part of making sure that it doesn't exist anymore. Thank you.